Good morning. Welcome to Backchat. I'm Hugh Jewett and your co-host today is Danny Gittings. Danny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Our main topic this morning is democracy good for business. The financial secretary this week echoed warnings that not passing the political reform bill would push the stock market or could push the stock market down in Hong Kong. Some academics and experts claim that too much democracy in general produces a government that can be too populist, unable to make tough decisions and too willing to go for short-term fixes than real sustainable economic growth. And there is some evidence of this in history and around the world. So does economic growth go hand in hand with democratic regimes, or is authoritarianism, done well, the fastest path to wealth? Would China be growing so fast under a democratic system like India's? Drop us an email with your thoughts. Our address, backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page, Backchat and RTHK Radio 3, and comment there, or call us 233 88266 after 9:20, Dangerous Dim Sum. Joining us for the first discussion we have with us David Webb in our central studio, founder of website.com, Dr. George Cawthorley, who's vice chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation, and Professor Richard Wong, chair of economics in the School of Economics and Finance at the University of Hong Kong. Richard Wong, good morning to you.
Morning.
Hi, maybe we'll start with you because it was something that you wrote in the South China Morning Post this week, which was quite interesting and provocative and was responded to also by Jake van der Kamp, the columnist there as well, quite directly. Now, you were writing about the relationship between economic growth and democracy. I think what you were saying was, or you were citing suggestions that some democracy is good, but too much can be detrimental to the economy. Is that right?
Well, democracy is an idea. You cannot have too little of it. You know, plenty of it is not a problem. It's just that how democracy has developed in the mature democracies is that they have evolved into protection of vested interests of vocal minorities, and these things have led to a highly regulatory environment in which it becomes very difficult to encourage new economic activity, old industries get protected and so forth. And all these regulatory problems that has emerged are leading to political divisiveness. Now, so all this is lumped under is a more or less democracy, which is sort of a shorthand word. But the important point is the way democracy was first created as geographic constituencies and how you aggregate opinion sometimes do not promote competition.
An example of that would be, say, the United States, what you're talking about?
Continental Europe is even worse.
Okay.
Particularly because continental Europe has proportional representation in geographical constituencies. But the United States have also evolved in that because of gerrymandering.
Okay, and so like in continental Europe, you have lots of coalitions, you have a lot of small parties, small interests that are kind of overrepresented. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, that's pretty much the idea.
So you said that you started off by saying democracy is a good thing. You can't have too much of it.
Yes.
So what are you saying here? That is in principle it's a good thing, but how in the way it's developed in the US or in Europe, and of course we should remember the US and European systems are two very different systems in terms of how they implement democracy. Whichever way you implement it, it seems to lead to problems.
When democracy was first introduced, we had an agricultural society. It was very natural to form elections, especially in larger geographical countries, through local geographical constituencies. And in that sense, a lot of the interest would be economic activity and where you live, residential, domestic residents, are overlapped. Over time, this is no longer the case in industrial economies, but the political system that we created 100 years ago remains the same. And it has evolved in a way, you know, because of geographic constituencies in most of these countries, some are more rigid and others less so, have become a deterrent on allowing greater economic openness and competition. The very well-known descriptions of NIMBY, not in my backyard, phenomenon. It's one of those phenomena. So more democracy is an idea, is fine, but how you implement it are specific concrete arrangements. And I think there has been more or less, you know, different models, but by and large, they are based on a way of aggregating opinion that has not always worked, particularly after, you know, 100 years or so. And this is what happens. If the rules were to encourage economic competition, we wouldn't have seen situations in which you see democracies which, after a period of time, actually fall back into authoritarian regimes. You have coup d'etat. You know, one of the great awakening calls was, why did Latin America actually reverted back to authoritarianism? And many countries that went democratic actually went back.
Yeah, hey, there's a problem here. I read your article, and you cite this Latin America example has been extensively quoted by Harvard scholars, but there are plenty of other examples. I mean, think closer to home. Think of Taiwan, South Korea. All these countries emerged from essentially autocracy to now be well-functioning democracies, and indeed presidential democracies like the same sort of style as the ones that in South America failed. So you're only really looking at one side of the equation there.
I'm not looking at one side of the equation. I'm just saying that there is enough to lead us to rethink this problem. I think debate is very lively. The question is, it seems to be unquestioned that democracy will lead to economic growth. And that is not the case. Mm. And that is important. This is not an argument against democracy as an idea. It's an issue about, let us examine how are we structuring specifically political systems. There is a lot of variation, but there's a great deal of affinity, and largely because we have developed that. You see, democracy is only about 150 years old, you know, maybe 200, depending on which country you look at, and therefore they all come from agrarian backgrounds.
Yeah, David Webb, what do you make of this? Look at the example, say, of India and China. I mean, every example, of course, has its own complications and so on. Look at India and China. The startling difference is the role of the government, basically. And in China, it seems to be effective. It seems to have worked to stimulate the economy. The country is growing in economically.
What's worked?
The actions of the central authorities work in China. They don't work in India.
Well,
it seems like the actions political of the central system in India is a hindrance to economic.
I think we're confusing economic policies with the polity, the system of governance. The Chinese government, for 30 years after 1949, pursued policies which destroyed its economy and drove the economic output into the ground. It was only in 1979 when Deng Xiaoping realized that they needed to pursue more market-based approaches that they started very gradually to liberalize the economy. That nothing changed in the political structure, but they changed their policies. So one must be careful not to confuse the system of governance and appointment of government with the policies that they then adopt.
Isn't that the point? They could change their policies. I mean, in an authoritarian state like that, they didn't face the same sort of resistance that you would have in a democracy to changing your policies.
Well, I think there would be probably, if there had been a democracy in China in 1979, and well before, there would have been an election of a party which pursued more liberal policies. And that's the great thing about democracy, that you can correct the situation if you get bad policy making. Today, of course, we're watching the UK election results coming in. I grew up in the UK in the 1970s when there was a Labour government and there were very socialist policies that were destroying the economy. We had electricity blackouts. We had 3-day weeks. It was not a change in the parliamentary system, which has been standing there for a very long time, but a change in the government and the policies that brought in the shift back towards capitalism and Thatcher's policies, which boosted the economic output of the UK by privatisation and so on. So it was not a change in the system. But I would agree. Let me just say a few things about Richard Wong's article. There was this nice picture, a scattergram with an inverted smiley, a sort of upside down curve, and some sort of connection, claiming that if you have too much democracy, then you get lower economic growth. And that actually comes not from a 2004 paper, as he said in the article, but from a 1994 paper by Robert Barrow. He got the date wrong, and it's important.
You've been doing your research, David Webb.
Yes, I've read the paper, and the important point here is that Robert Barrow's study was based on 100 countries between 1960 and 1990, so it completely misses the collapse of the Soviet Union, for example.
And the rise of China.
And the rise of, well, the most of the rise of China, yes.
Which is a pretty big confirming instance.
And, it's one data point, one country.
I think 2004 is because it was from the second edition of the book.
The paper was...
I looked at it myself. I agree. I read the paper as well. But it was published in 94, but I think it was 2004.
It was published in 94 and
because I don't think we need a debate. It was published in 1994.
It was the second edition.
I don't know if he updated the data set or not.
I don't think he updated the data set.
He didn't. Okay, so we're agreed then. It was based on...
I think he did, actually, but some of the points are different.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think this is an important issue. It's just that this is an evidence.
I just wanted to point out it probably doesn't cover a lot of recent economic history. The last 25 years' worth of history are not covered by the study.
We have the rise of...
Democracy movements in the Middle East. I don't know what that would do to the data set, whether, for example, one could point to what happened in Tunisia as the first of the Arab Springs was largely driven by the increases in the price of bread and the collapsing economy under a dictatorship. I think there's general agreement that up to a point at least, democracy adds value to the economy. And also, we must be careful when we talk about economic growth. That's a measure of the overall output of the economy, not of the well-being of its citizens. It depends how that growth is distributed. You may actually get a better overall prosperity of the citizenship with slightly lower economic growth
if it results in distribution changes. The smiley figure that we talk about held try to held constant a lot of factors. So this is as the chart shows, it's about the unexplained part. The other thing is this is not a causation. This is a correlation. Mm. You need a theory to interpret it, and I venture to offer that, you know, the modernization hypothesis was very good in explaining the upward moving part, which is when you move out of a fairly authoritarian, autocratic situation, democracy, you know, relaxation is good for the economy. Mm. And yet, as you get more mature, you know, then democracy actually, despite, you know, that you can change policies that are bad and over time, these things happen very slowly.
And yeah, all I'm saying is that
sometimes it doesn't.
Let's not confuse the measure of...
That is why the result is, you know, when you look at some of the data, there's evidence shows, you know, democracy has its ideal and good aspects in terms of allowing bad policies, non-responsive parties to be removed from power, which is the strength of democracy. And yet, these things don't happen frequently enough. It still puts a brake on economic growth.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about economic growth.
We have another guest. George Cawthorley, Vice Chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation. Dr. Cawthorley, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Which side are you on?
I'm on the side that democracy helps growth. I subscribe to the view that there is a limit to how far economies can develop without democracy, and that probably by the 1990s, Hong Kong had reached a point of diminishing returns due to the lack of a competition of ideas, which the democratic system fosters. So basically, Hong Kong's economy has been underperforming for at least 20 years due to the absence of a democratic system. And even if the government proposals are voted through, we're still not being offered a fully democratic system as it is constrained. Yeah. It constrains choice of candidate, and that constraint is exercised by a nomination committee.
No, surely we have a more representative government now than we used to, say, in the 90s, and we had more economic growth in the 90s.
Well, I think another issue you have to look at is that, you know, economies do not grow at the same rate forever. They become mature and they slow down. Mm. And I think perhaps that's something that is not actually reflected in the Barros argument, is that dictatorial economies tend to be emerging economies maybe show greater growth rates. But I mean, I think there's a lot of published evidence that concludes that democracy does, on balance, enhance economic growth. I think that's a very important yeah. issue.
I would agree with one of Richard Wong's points, which is that one must look at the types of democracy that come out of this, whether it's a parliamentary one where you give a mandate for 5 years, as they will possibly today, to a party or coalition of parties that can then prove their policies and give them a 5-year test, as opposed to the presidential-led or executive-led system, in the US's case, 3 layers, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, where they're often in conflict. And the president, if he has a set of economic policies, is unable to prove that they work because he's opposed by a house with a different political shade.
You're a fan of the British system.
So I do prefer the sort of single layer parliamentary approach. I do think that gives a better outcome in terms of pursuing the policies of the day. Now, whether the policies are right, of course, they weren't in the 1970s with Labour, with nationalisation and the UK government owning huge chunks of the economy. But that's also the case in China today, for example. The market reforms in China in terms of control have stalled because the state can't bring itself to sell down the state-owned enterprises. And in fact, rather than allow them to be broken up and more competitive, is actually going around merging them right now and creating giant companies that have no real competition domestically. And that's one of the issues that's held Hong Kong back, is the cartels, the lack of competition. Although we do now have a competition ordinance, it's not yet been put into effect. The chief executive can't somehow bring himself to press the button on that. And when it does come into effect, it's full of holes. It doesn't prevent mergers, for example, of cartels, so that if they were previously price-fixing, they can just form a joint venture instead.
Okay, you mentioned competition, and George Cawthorley, you also mentioned a competition of ideas. Here's the thoughts of Henry on our Facebook page. Thanks very much, Henry. Henry says, democracy's major limitation is acrimonious arguments arising from different stakeholders and groups. Consequently, social tension increases, precious time is lost, and the end result is a neither here nor there compromise carrying a higher cost due to inflation. Democracy's self-correcting mechanism is slow, and only when it goes extremely wrong would it start recorrecting itself, again going through endless debate. An example is the UK's high-speed HS2, first proposed in 2009. Not a single inch has been built, and with budget ballooning and completion date being pushed forward every day. In the business world...
In Hong Kong, we have a ballooning budget and the Kowloon Express link to Shenzhen. $90 billion and a waste of money.
We're building it, though.
we're building it, and it's a waste of money. And there was no economic analysis on that.
Democratic systems are at loggerheads with the extremely rapid changing political and economic dynamics. Time lost is money and opportunity lost. An example is the much-talked-about China model, which overcomes these hurdles. Business and investments need horizons of 5 to 30 years and don't like uncertainties. When investment dries up in an uncertain environment, it's the whole economy that would suffer. Hong Kong has seen property and stock markets fall during Sino-British Hong Kong talks and companies leaving Hong Kong, with the void filled by mainland companies on instructions received, says Henry. George Cawthorley, what about that? You can have too much competition. Sometimes you don't want a competition for ideas. You want to get things done.
You want to get things done, yes, but how about if you adopt the wrong policies and you have those entrenched for years and years and years? I mean, I think things cut both ways, and I still think on balance the democracy gives you some control over changing what's wrong and preventing big disasters from bad policies.
You put a note of caution in there, didn't you? You said on balance. You agreed democracy has its limitations as well.
Well, I think everything has its limitations. This is not a perfect world. And you can go back to the old Churchill phrase about democracy being lousy, but the least lousy of all the lousy systems we have. And I think, that is the situation. And basically, of course, it's all underpinned by human beings, and human beings are far from perfect.
If you don't have democracy, what you do tend to get is the vast majority of dictatorships in the world are not beneficial to their people. There's just a few places that you could look at for very isolated reasons that have been economically successful. And maybe it's because they had a dictator that happened to be a very good economic manager and made some relatively good choices for the economy.
Yeah, I mean,
but you're not going to get that most of the time. Those are outliers. What you tend to get is self-interested pocket-filling. You get princelings. You get children in the economy. If you look at Suharto's Indonesia, for example, and the percentage of the economy that his children had interests in, you see how much of the economic output was diverted.
And the Philippines?
What about the Philippines?
Well, surely that's just a phenomenon you could find in democracies. You could find them in authoritarian regimes.
I think in the Philippines case, you've got to look at the level of corruption, and you've got to look also at the influence of the Catholic Church on policymaking as
Latin
well. Because
America,
their birth rate has been.
You can find cases either way. In Africa, you can find corrupt democracies. You can find non-corrupt authoritarian regimes.
I think this is precisely the point. The issue is not to pitch authoritarianism with democracy, but the point that I was trying to make in the article was there are different types of democracies, and democracies being entrenched, mature, tend to ossify. They also tend to be dominated by powerful vested interest groups, and election rules and constitutional arrangements matter, and that is why we have a phenomenon, the Barrow phenomenon, whether it's 1994, 2004, doesn't really matter. There is evidence, and the important point is you're not trying to prove a case by citing 10 examples that are in favor and 10 examples are not in favor. The question is very clear, and that is, democracy performs well sometimes and not other times. It is not, and we have to get to the heart of it, why it works sometimes and why it doesn't. Now, authoritarianism is a completely different problem. What is also a matter, and the amount of research that I've read in this area seems to suggest that there is one variable, one factor that is clearly always works in terms of promoting economic growth, whereas democracy doesn't work all the time. It sometimes works, it sometimes doesn't, but one factor works all the time, and that is the rule of law. Rule of law has a robust and strong effect. Now, rule of law is quite related to democracy, and yet sometimes democracy actually violates the rule of law. It creates exceptions, it makes discretionary choices, just as authoritarian government. You don't always have the rule of law, you have the rule of lawyers, and law has become so complicated that only the privileged, the powerful, the rich can actually utilize it, and that's one of the problems in a democracy.
Yes, Richard, but that is a matter of the laws that are passed by democratic governments are largely a matter of policies of those governments, and you do get some governments that introduce laws which reduce economic prosperity. For example, overly rigid labor laws that make it hard to fire anybody will tend to deter employment, and you can end up with overly generous welfare schemes that tend to deter job seeking.
Such laws are more likely to be a product of democracy.
You can have tax laws that aren't properly effective in Greece, for example. There's all sorts of examples, but these are the product of the democracy, and equally the democracy can produce laws which are beneficial, such as a sensible competition law that we should have in Hong Kong would break up the cartels.
I don't know much about it, but tax laws in the United States are a nightmare, aren't they? Because of the fragmentation, everyone's had the vested interest.
And there you've got to look at this again.
I want an exception. You end up with this terrible, dreadful muddle of a jigsaw puzzle of legislation.
Yeah, and also sorts of pork barrel politics.
But it's not because of democracy. What you might call too much democracy.
No, it's because of the type of democracy that they have.
Yeah, sure.
It's because of the federal system. It's because of the two houses of Congress versus the president. It's a reflection of their particular political structure. But nevertheless, it's a pretty successful economy that tends to produce gigantic and innovative companies.
Roger Wong was talking about. Yeah, it's not exactly too much democracy, but it tends to ossify. You get.
I don't think it does. So much.
Keeping up of legislation.
Would you describe the UK democracy as ossified? I think it's pretty dynamic at the moment. You've got coalitions being negotiated.
Richard Wong's example, I noticed, was continental Europe.
Yes, you switched back, haven't you, David Webb, from the US to the UK, haven't you? Because you much prefer the UK system.
I don't think the US is ossified either. I think there are clear problems with the campaign finance system.
Because of the constitutional deadlock. It's deadlocked, isn't it?
I don't think it's entirely deadlocked. They do pass budgets. They have heated negotiations and they pass budgets.
They go to the brink far more even than we do in Hong Kong, don't they, on budgets? I mean, is it a healthy situation where you have to shut down your federal government to pass a budget?
It's not a healthy situation, and as I said, I prefer the parliamentary system, where you have a majority of the of the parliament deciding the budget.
May I interject? The thing is, I'm not arguing against democracy. Mm. There are good examples. If the only example one can give is the UK, this is not a very impressive record, because more than 100 countries call themselves democracies, and that is the point. It varies a great deal. Look at continental Europe. You know, some function better, most don't. Democracies is a shame. The fastest growing economy in the Middle
East. Has Germany functioned well?
Was Tunisia, right? Tunisia was the most successful economy in all of the Middle East. And yet, it was very. It's a complex issue. Mm. That's my point. And therefore, one should not look at it as purely I have an ideal form of democratic. I mean, the ideal is great. Who would argue against it these days, right?
Okay.
But the practice is different. It varies enormously.
There are people, of course, who will argue against it these days. Maybe we'll turn a little bit more to Hong Kong when we return to the topic in just about 4 minutes' time after the news at 9 o'clock. Quite a few emails and comments on our Facebook page coming in. Thank you very much indeed for those. A reminder that our address is backchat@rthk.hk. You can always call us as well, 233-88266. An email from TC, who says, dear host, there's no direct correlation between democracy and business development. The four Asian tigers are a good example of better economic developments in authoritarian regimes. However, in a democracy, the government can't just cater to the interests of the economically and politically connected. Thus, a broader spectrum of people benefit economically in a democracy. What is the point of high economic growth when only a few benefit? Asks TC. I think that was a point also made by David Webb. Well, what do you think? Drop us a line. You can do it now as we go to the news. Preceded by the weather, mainly cloudy with sunny periods today. Isolated showers and sunny intervals over the weekend. 28 degrees now. Humidity is at 82%. Welcome back. This is Backchat on a Friday morning, last one of the week. We're talking about democracy and economic growth and their relationship. Is democracy good for business? Inspired by various things, including an article by Professor Richard Wong this week in the South China Morning Post. He's the Chair of Economics in the School of Economics and Finance at the University of Hong Kong. He joins us along with Dr. George Cawthorley, who's Vice Chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Foundation, and David Webb, who's a shareholder activist, founder of website.com. And also comments, for example, by John Jung this week, echoing warnings that not passing the political reform bill in Hong Kong would affect or could affect the stock market in Hong Kong adversely, driving it down. What do you think of the relationship? Do you think that democracy fosters economic growth, or do you think there are limits, or where do you sit, and what examples would you cite from around the world? Or from history. Anthony says he cites an article from The Economist, Lessons from California, The Perils of Extreme Democracy. Anthony says it's kind of empirical findings and logical reasoning. In extreme democracy, we suffer from the tyranny of the gullible majority, as sadly wise people are always the minority. That's why a hybrid system works well in the developed markets, such as Singapore and Hong Kong. Just look at the high crime rates, high debt levels, unproductiveness, poor education systems in the US, UK, and other developed European countries. Unfortunately, the gullible majority in Hong Kong don't read The Economist or other thought pieces with global perspective. They prefer the selected and twisted news from Apple Daily, says Anthony. Thank you very much indeed for that comment. Backchat@rthk.hk. You can go to our Facebook page as well. We've got some interesting comments there, which we'll get to in a moment. We've got a caller on the line now. It's Mike. Hello, Mike.
You guys are just skirting around the reasons why democracy works or it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But you haven't hit it on the head yet, and it's the people.
Go on, tell us.
You mean the leaders?
I mean, there was a Harvard professor that interviewed his graduate student from China, and he was so surprised on how people in America obey laws, line up, you know, do things, you know, don't cut people off. You know, they're so much more polite. They're so much politer than the people in China, where democracy just wouldn't work because of the people.
The last time I was in Singapore, people were pretty polite there sometimes.
And just, you know, in Hong Kong, and in Hong Kong, they're learning. I mean, do you see I had a discussion with one of the politicians here in Hong Kong a few years ago, and I said, how can we really, you know, trust a politician when they don't even obey the traffic lights? I mean, they walk against, and she denied it and wanted to have pictures taken, and I go, oh, have you never jaywalked in Hong Kong? No. And I says, well, that's really the crux of the problem. You're telling us something, you know, that's almost unbelievable. Because you know as well as I knew that years ago it was terrible, and now people are learning and they're obeying laws.
You say there's a link between that and more democracy in Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, here's the situation. I mean, it was told that the tax situation in the U.S. is so cumbersome, and the reason why it's so cumbersome is because of democracy. Because you have people that want to get into power, and they promise people a certain group no taxes to that certain group, so they'll get voted in. And you know it gets more and more complicated because the promises get because of democracy. Now, if it was a flat tax, I think one of the candidates, Ben Carson, he says, you know, everybody gets taxed. A percentage of what they make is a fair system, and no candidate is going to come up and say, you know what, there's going to be no taxes, we're going to lower tax. No, these taxes, that aspect is going to be out of the equation. And so reasons democracies work and economies work is it's the people. It's got nothing to do with the systems. It's whether the people are going to be honest, hardworking, or there are going to be people that are going to try to milk the system. And so when you got a bunch of people that have learned how to milk the system, your economy is going to suffer.
Hmm. Okay, Mike, thanks very much indeed.
It's the people, folks.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much indeed. Take your point. Backchat at rthk.hk is our email address. You can just call us, as Mike has done, 233-88266.
Comments continuing to flood in. We've had a lot of emails. Let's try and get through those we can. One of our most regular correspondents, Bowen, saying, I think nobody is so naive as to suggest that democracy necessarily leads to more economic growth. I agree with David Webb that there is little evidence that authoritarianism has a greater propensity to result in policies that are good for economic growth, or else the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China under Mao would long have enjoyed prosperous economies. I also agree that good economic policies and the presence or absence of democracy are separate issues. The point with having democracies has more to do with throwing obstacles in the way of oppression and persecution and enhancing basic rights and liberties. Hong Kong has, up until this stage, not enjoyed much democracy, as it's so properly called. And Hong Kong has lagged behind many other countries with a less developed and sophisticated social infrastructure. It's clear that the lack of democracy is holding Hong Kong back in all sorts of ways, as mentioned by another of your guests. What Henry, referring to the earlier comments from Henry on our Facebook page, what Henry has done is just to accentuate all the negative possibilities of democracy. One could do the same with authoritarianism on a much grander scale. Thank you very much, Bowen, as always.
George Cawthorley, you're still there?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Good. I mean, you're kind of, you know, an outlier, I guess, among business people, surely, in your support of democracy. In general, in Hong Kong, the business community is pretty wary of democracy, isn't it? And that's for a reason, because it's not good for business.
Well, I just don't agree that it's not good for business. It's not. Maybe it's not good for vested interests. And of course, this is what Hong Kong has worked under for decades, and these people have become very comfortable with their monopolies. But I don't think there is any evidence that, in general, if you take nations all over the world, that democracy is not good for business.
Well, I mean, again, we go back to examples like the Philippines, don't we?
Well, I think David mentioned
Philippines is riddled with cartels, and
you've got things. You've got corruption, which is a big hindrance to having a fluid economic system.
David Webb, how about that? We haven't touched on the example of Singapore. I'm sure you have strong feelings on this. I mean, Singapore's often described perhaps as a managed or controlled democracy, but yet it's been growing faster than Hong Kong in recent years, hasn't it?
I would put it firmly in the category of non-democracy.
Well, okay. Well, however we did, it's not have a long debate, but certainly,
it's a corporate conglomerate, basically.
And it's what
Deng Xiaoping thought when he visited there. He thought, wow, this is wonderful. Because you can control everything and still be economically successful. And surely we can do that in China if we just adopt Singapore's policies.
It's worked in Singapore, hasn't it?
But he's wrong, actually. Singapore is a little oasis of political stability and relatively good economic choices and policies surrounded by a number of problematic countries. And it has, in that sense, it's a bit like Hong Kong in the sense that it's a parasitical economy. It's benefited from those economies around it. But the fact remains there.
It grows faster than Hong Kong in recent years.
I haven't looked at the year by year comparison.
They've
done a number of things that I respect, such as electronic road pricing, for example, to ration the space on their roads. There's a lot of good policy making there, but this is an outlier in terms of the global data set of countries with largely dictatorial governments, that most of which produce adverse economic outcomes. So I praise their policy making, but I don't praise their system, and they are gradually shifting towards a more open political structure.
Richard Wong, I think you wanted to come back on the Singapore example.
I wouldn't think that Singapore is a democracy. I think it's an authoritarian government, although it has elections. But the thing is,
doesn't that reinforce the point?
The question is not whether it is a democracy or isn't. Let's look at Singapore. Let's look at the Philippines. It has been a democracy for a long, long time as a political system. Nobody doubts it. What has it been able to prevent all the powerful families from controlling not only the economy but Congress? Nothing. Right. This has been a democracy for over 100 years. It has continued to go. Sometimes it has been more democratic than other times, and you had an authoritarian.
Well, I don't think under Ferdinand Marcos it was a democracy, and therefore
the question there is really, as I hear people say, about the people versus the system. It's about the rule of law. The rule of law promises everyone equal. What kind of political system can ensure that? I do think democracy has a much better shot at it than an authoritarian government. I don't doubt that. The question is, there are many shades of democracy. And how to get the democracy right is really the big challenge.
Richard, then, that a basic law should be a very bad
election system. It has a geographic constituency, which pretends it has a lot of legitimacy, and yet it is direct. It's proportional representation. It fragments. It gives enormous power to vocal minorities. It's not representative. It's just highly undemocratic, and yet it has a veneer of being a highly democratic. Now, if this system runs havoc in Hong Kong, and as it grows, it will be a system that will be very bad for economic development.
Do you think then, Richard, that 25 years after the Basic Law was promulgated, it's time to review whether we need a parliamentary democracy within that law rather than the executive-led system and also the current hidden dual house with the FCs and the geographic constituencies having to approve things separately? Shouldn't we then start a new consultation on whether we have the right democratic design within the Basic Law or move towards a parliamentary system?
Richard Wong?
If I were to do it in my class with my students as an academic exercise, it would be a wonderful thing to do. The reality of politics is if you review all this stuff, you may lose what you already have.
So you say it'd be nice in an ideal world, but not practical.
Yeah, not practical.
Not sure that we have very much at the moment.
Okay, just bringing it back to Hong Kong, and the region, first of all. Kelvin, in a Facebook comment, says, need you look far? Just look how the two economies on both sides of the Taiwan Strait have fared in the past few decades. You get the answer already. There is no direct relationship between populist democracy and economic growth. Facts and figures actually suggest that the converse is true. And referring to John Jung's comments about the stock market, I think, Rod on our Facebook page, thanks Rod, says, I disagree with the premise that a rising stock market equals a growing economy. Until a few years ago, the Zimbabwe stock market was one of the best performing stock markets because they were printing so much money at central bank level. The opposite is true. You can't have deflationary tendencies along with a rising standard of living. This happened in the USA and in Canada during the 1800s. Let's also not forget that GDP does not measure a rise in the standard of living. You can have a rising GDP while having a decline in the standard of living because you can fudge GDP figures with government spending.
Indeed. Says projects like the tunnel to Shenzhen from Kowloon.
Okay. Tom, in an email says, thank you and other listeners for keeping the Hong Kong electoral system reform discourse on the ethical issues around fairness, natural justice and democracy. The discussion of serious issues of what is a fair and democratic election system with individuals with no principle nor authenticity and always look at the short-term financial gain is an absolute waste of time. The threat from Mr. Jung about the stock market collapsing and economic negative impact is just like his threats in the past 2 years about how Occupy Central would damage the Hong Kong economy. Look what happened since. However, all those pro-establishment figures and Hong Kong government senior officials like to confuse Hong Kong people between the concepts of national security of China and the CCP interest. These are different concepts and definitely not interchangeable terms. It's important to note that once a very large-scale electoral system has been in place, for example, like the UK parliamentary system is by and large the same since 1918, it's extremely difficult to make any subsequent substantial changes to it, even in an open Western democratic society. So don't pocket first, nor make an unfair and unjust electoral system happen for 7 million Hong Kong people. Focus on the discussions firmly on the social needs for a just and fair election system for the CE and for LegCo. That comes from Tom.
George Corfoley, we've had so many different examples cited here, haven't we? Singapore, Philippines, US, UK. Isn't the problem you can almost pick and choose any example you want to suit your purposes?
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, I just like to get back to a point that Richard made regarding political party fragmentation and how that upsets decision making, and you get some very weird people elected. And there's a very interesting study done by John Carey of Dartmouth and Simon Hicks of the London School of Economics, in which they looked at the governance outcomes of 609 elections in 81 democracies between 1945 and 2006. And basically they came to the conclusion that there was a balance that could be struck between having a system whereby you had a reasonable amount of different views represented in your legislature, but you didn't have so many different views that you could never get around to getting a decision on anything. And they came up with a constituency size, a multi-seat constituency size that should be between 4 and 6 candidates or 4 and 6 members, and they felt that would deliver a much more stable form of government, and of course that would be under proportional representation.
I was going to say, would that be more stable than a one seat system? It was first past the post.
Yeah, because a one seat system you don't get the kind of diverse representation. In effect, you get the ruling party.
Well, you end up with a two-party system, typically, when you only have a first-past-the-post system, although it has diverged in the UK from that. But.
And basically, from their research, first-past-the-post system was not the most effective system in terms of giving people the representation that they would like.
It's, in Hong Kong's less case, democratic, we've got... that's an example, isn't it, David Webb? The first-past-the-post is kind of undemocratic, really.
It depends how you do it.
But you get a strong government. So you weigh up those advantages. It's less democratic, but you have a strong government.
You get a mandated government for a five-year period, and possibly one which doesn't have to negotiate a coalition to form a government. So that's one thing, but the first past the post system can be implemented in different ways. You can have single transferable votes, for example, so that you can confidently vote for the third party on the list, knowing that if they don't succeed, your vote will be transferred to your second choice, and it will have an impact then on whether the other one of the other two parties gets elected. That that's some, a reform that I think should have happened in the UK but didn't. They actually went to a referendum on that after the last general election. But, of course, the two major parties were very much opposed to making it easier for third or fourth parties to have real chances.
Well, they had a referendum, so is everyone else in Britain. No one's...
Well, I don't think the actual dynamics of it were very well explained. But anyway, that's what happened. And in Hong Kong's case, we have some constituencies with 9 seats, and the resulting fragmentation is very obvious, that you can get elected practically with about 6% of the vote in those big constituencies. And even the government, I think, here, the pro-Beijing side, has begun to recognize that that might not be the best way forward, and they might need to have, rather than having these 5 groups of seats, they might make it 10 groups of seats with 5 in each group, and that's towards the number that George is suggesting, that 4 or 5 seats in a constituency with proportional representation is a better way forward. But I still think we should introduce the single transferable vote, so that if your list of candidates is unsuccessful,
We have to be careful going into the mechanics of different electoral systems. Richard Wong, let's go back to your article that just started the whole discussion. Just to sum it up, are you saying that democracy, let's say universal suffrage here in Hong Kong, won't necessarily improve economic growth and indeed good governance in Hong Kong? Is that the logical consequence of what you're saying?
No, that's not the logical consequence of what I'm saying. The logical consequence is the current, my view is, the current electoral systems, both functional and geographic, is a pretty disastrous arrangement.
Yep.
Which encourages enormous fragmentation.
Okay, we've got consensus there.
Protection of vested interests, minority interests, in all, including NIMBY behavior of all kinds. This is a terrible system. Now, how do you cut through the system in a practical way? Okay, and this is what I would prefer, and that is my guess would be, and nobody has a crystal ball, that if we actually move forward with our election proposals, there is a chance that we may make some changes forward.
You would like universal suffrage for the chief executive because you'd say it's less of the NIMBY scenario, isn't it? Because Hong Kong-wide is voting.
Yes. And we could get rid of the chap after 5 years if we don't like him.
Only if the nominating committee agrees, and that's the problem. It's still stacked with vested interests.
Yeah, but the nominating committee cannot control everyone.
It can only approve.
Right? Yeah,
it approves the candidates. Yeah, it's an Iranian-style proposal.
Candidates are not robots. Okay, right? And they would like to remain in office, and it is well known, particularly in authoritarian systems. Right, your underlings are very rebellious.
You have to. You end up, if you look at the voting weights in the election committee, you only actually have about, if you look at the people who elect the members of the committee and those who are directly appointed to the committee, you only need about 3,500 of the electorate to have 627 seats, which, including the 27 pandems, gives you the majority you need to approve candidates. So it is heavily concentrated towards vested interests in the property sector, the hotel sector. I know you sit on a number of boards in that sector, Sun and Kai and so on, and you know these companies have multiple votes through different sectors that stack up to a majority of the nominating committee.
Richard Wong, I think
the important thing is this is let's get it correct. The nominating power is one element of power. How many elected officials in the US, UK actually deliver on what they promise? Right? Very few.
Well, they have both a mandate and an obligation to try.
That is why the firing decision. You see, we all know, if we are employers, we know that the most powerful hold we have over our employees is not the hiring, because hiring is, you don't really know the candidate very well. And what they show up in interviews, what they tell you they're capable to do, is probably quite exaggerated. You know, after you have hired this firm, that you would know that the real control in terms of performance and incentives is that you hold a firing decision, and that is the beauty of an electoral system.
Right.
And that is, I think, a good point about a democracy, because you can actually fire somebody.
All right. Okay. A few comments from listeners just to wrap up. Anthony Back says, David Webb brought up a very interesting point. Germany, in fact, the country also suffered the burst of property market after the merger of East-West Germany's, but just more than 10 years earlier than other European countries, so it could not take part in the real estate frenzy. Now, Germany is also feeling the pain of democracy. The Greek government, democratically elected, probably will default the debt. Big loss to Germany financially. It comes from Anthony. Jim says, compare India's growth, the largest democracy in the world, with that of China. One has to question what countries are actually democratic. And Jason points out, The Economist says that Hong Kong ranks first in its crony capitalism index, and that the USSR was the fastest growing economy in the world for 60 years, seducing many commentators. People supporting authoritarian economic growth need to take a longer view, says Jason. Thank you very much indeed for those comments. And thanks to our guests this morning, to Richard Wong, Professor Richard Wong from the University of Hong Kong, Dr. George Cawthorley of the Democratic Foundation, and David Webb of website.com. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today, and all those who emailed as well.